We all face difficult times in our lives. Maybe it's the prospect of a divorce, news about a diagnosis, deciding to come clean about a dishonest act, moving older parents to a nursing home, you name it. While a choice of who to confide in might seem obvious, a spouse, a close friend, or a family member, our guest has learned that we often choose acquaintances or even strangers or near strangers instead. Mario Luis Small is a sociologist and Grafstein Family Professor of Sociology at Harvard University. He joins us now to talk about his recent book. It's called Someone to Talk To. Mario, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
Well, you in your book, you say when you're trying to explain what you're working on to people, you'd ask them a few questions that might be used in a sociological survey. Can you tell us about those questions to get us started thinking about who we talk to?
Yeah, it's a pretty standard set of questions. So imagine if I ask you in a survey, from time to time, there are people we need to talk to when we have to something important and personal to confide in someone. Who are the people in your life who you turn to? And what you find, if you're like me, is that most people will say something like, well, if in my case, for example, it's my wife, probably my closest colleague at work, and maybe one of my closest friends from childhood who I've been in touch with for 30 years or so. But then what's interesting is that if you ask him a very different set of questions, you might get a very different answer. Suppose that instead of doing that, if I said, look, think about everything you're experiencing right now, and think about the two, maybe three most personally important, perhaps difficult things that you're going through right now, whatever they are. And Rob, I won't ask you to tell me, but just try to think about them. It could be something with your health, perhaps something with your relationships, maybe your finances, maybe some crisis that was unexpected. Just think about them. Now that you have them in mind, I'm going to ask you a very different question. Now think about the very last time you talked to anybody about that first thing you thought about, or the last time you talked to anyone about that second thing. Now, what's interesting is that when I think about this question, almost always, at least one or the two last people I actually talked to turn out to be people very different from who I would normally say are the people I usually confide in. And more importantly, those other people, the people I've often talked to, are sometimes people I'm actually not that close to, people who in theory aren't even the kind of people I would call my confidants. And that is the issue I started exploring.
And you write that this isn't just you, based on surveys and then based on your work for this book, following a group of graduate students in different departments. This is super common. We think of the people who are close to us as the people we'd talk to. Again, maybe that spouse, sibling, whatever. But when push comes to shove, the people we talk to are not always, not usually even those close people. How common is it for us to reach outside that close network to talk about the serious stuff?
Very, very common. So it turns out that if you ask people, there are lots of different ways of asking this question, but if you ask them just, hey, who do you think you talk to, or who are you regularly close to, they're going to name on average, at least Americans will name on average, somewhere between 3 and 4.5, 5 people, depending on how you frame the question. Now, I found using a data representative of the U.S. population, we asked a nationally representative population this question, and we asked them who they'd actually talked to the last time they talked to anyone. And we found that just about half the time, actually technically speaking, slightly more than half the time, the people they'd last talked to about the issues they told us were the most important issues in their life that concerned them were not actually people they were close to.
So who are we talking to then if it's not that close, what we might think of as our close support network? Who do we find and why do we pick them?
Now, that's part of what's interesting about this. So first, we'll talk to, pretty much anyone. Part of what's interesting is that if your listeners are like me, we tend to think of ourselves as pretty rational people who are not going to just go around and share our personal secrets or our personal difficulties with just any random person. But the truth is, if you look at the distribution of people that our respondents were willing to talk to, we're talking everything from bartenders, the person at the barbershop, the beautician at the nail salon, the person you're working out with at the gym, person in yoga class, a random colleague, a person who you run into on the elevator or a bus stop, or the person sitting next to you on the airplane. People actually will talk to a wide swath of people about their issues. Now, once you dig a little deeper, it gets a little more complicated because it turns out that people aren't just making decisions without thinking about them, although sometimes they actually are. But in truth, what ends up happening is people tend to turn to different people for different reasons. A lot of the time what happens is you're expressly trying to avoid the people you're close to, precisely because they're too close for comfort. Mm-hmm. You know, some people think about, you know, the people who, well, they found a lump in their body and they don't want to worry their spouse until they know for sure. So it takes them a while. It takes them a while to go to the doctor and start talking about this. And it's only when they're really sure that they're going to talk to their spouse. Or maybe the problem they're having involves their spouse or involves someone they're close to. Maybe they've done something shameful, right? The person who, I don't know, is going through financial difficulties and, I don't know, cheated on their taxes. They're not going to want to tell their close friends often because they don't want those people to have a negative impression of them. So a lot of the times, even though it sounds strange at the beginning, what ends up happening is people are just avoiding the people they're close to.
Mario Luis Small is with us. He's a sociologist, author of the book Someone to Talk To. He's writing about who we confide in and why it's often not the people closest to us in our lives. You write about, in the group of grad students you studied, one from a working class background at an expensive school, feeling like he was, you know, one problem away from kind of losing everything he'd built up toward. One person he didn't want to talk to was his mom for a variety of reasons. Can you tell us some of why he didn't reach out to that person who was close to him?
Absolutely. And this is part of what's interesting. I mean, I studied a population of graduate students. So even though they're, you know, pursuing higher degrees, they face as many problems as everyone else does. This was somebody who didn't have a lot of money. He was married. He had a child. And he had health insurance through his university. His wife, who was under 26, had health insurance through her own mother. But their child had no insurance. And so they were trying to get on Medicaid, et cetera. And he commuted to the office. And his big worry, that was one day, you know, he'd say, you know, gosh, if my truck breaks down and it's $1,000, we're done. I mean, I just have no savings, no nothing. Now, what's interesting is that this is something that, of course, worried him. And in addition to needing money, sometimes he just needed to talk about it. And what was powerful about his case is that even though just before we did our interview, he had told me that his mother was one of the closest people in his life and he was willing to talk to her about just about anything, he absolutely refused to talk to her about this issue. And the reason is simple. She was broke too. She didn't have a lot of money. She wasn't actually broke. She was poor. And so were his grandparents. And so he feared that the minute he brought it up, even if he was just trying to vent, you know, sometimes you just need to vent, oh my goodness, you know, the truck broke down or I don't know how I'm going to make it, that the mother would feel guilty and send him money that she didn't have, get into debt for his sake and so on. So it was in a sense, what he was trying to do was protect his own confidant, his own mother, from his own problems.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to point out that programs like AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, or other anonymous support groups are based on principles of anonymity so people can share really the worst moments of their lives freely with people who, in many cases, don't know them at all. And it's easier maybe than talking to someone you're close to.
Absolutely. And actually, I think to the extent that programs such as AA and NA work, a lot of the reason they work is the opportunity for people to just vent, to talk in a context, not just without judgment, and not just where your family, who you may be embarrassed or ashamed or have a hard time talking to, are going to be there, but also where people are going to understand. You know, Rob, that's one of the most important things we found, that often when people were going out and seeking people they were not close to, people who were basically sometimes even strangers, the major thing they were looking for was cognitive empathy, the sense that this person is going to understand my experience as I experience it. And that is one of the most powerful things that people often in places like AA report themselves finding.
Mario Luis Small is with us, professor of sociology at Harvard University. His new book is called Someone to Talk To. We're talking about who we choose to confide in when we deal with tough situations, why we choose them, and why it's often not the people who are closest to us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who do you think of as the person you'd go to talk to about a tough situation? And, phrasing it differently, who have you actually talked to about a tough situation lately? Is it somebody who's close to you, or maybe somebody with a little more distance, an acquaintance, a professional relationship, the person at the hair salon, say? Did somebody confide in you, somebody that you wouldn't have expected to? What helps you? Who does it help you to talk to? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation with Mario Luis Small, professor of sociology at Harvard University. We're talking about his most recent book, Someone to Talk To, looking at our social networks and who we go to when we've got something serious to talk about. Well, we want to talk to you. Who do you go to when you've got a serious issue in your life that you need to vent about, bounce it off of somebody else? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Problem with a job or a relationship? Who do you like to talk to? And is it that person you're close to on a day-to-day basis, or is it somebody with a little more distance? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mario, let's talk a little bit about what we can do with this, because it seems like this would have some practical application, this way of thinking about things, if we're trying to figure out ways to make it possible for, say, someone to report sexual harassment at work or bullying at school. Are there lessons we can draw here to find the right person for them to talk to?
Absolutely. So I would say sort of probably the most important lesson has to do with forgetting the assumption that people need to be really close to the person who needs to talk in order for them to be good confidants. The truth is, most of us, even if we don't see ourselves as very good listeners or very good speakers or whatever it is, can and have probably more often than we typically realize serve as confidants for others. One of the most powerful things I learned when studying this book was I was looking at the experiences of teachers who worked in public school districts where the fact that they were gay or lesbian was problematic, and so they had to keep it to themselves because it might have an impact on how they were evaluated professionally. Now, one of the very interesting things I learned in that context is when many of these teachers eventually ended up coming out, they did so to people who just happened to be present and willing to listen at the time they needed to do it. In other words, the predicament, this was in the 1990s. This was some narratives of people who were at a time in a context where there was less openness about sexuality than there is now, even though, as we all know, there's still we still have a ways to go. And one of the most powerful things I learned from their experiences was that really the presence of somebody willing to talk is more important than the fact that that person has an especially close relationship to you. I would say a second quick lesson that's powerful is the importance of empathy over sympathy. Now, we often think about sympathy as being important, being sympathetic. But the truth is, a lot of what I found is that most of the people who were looking for an ear weren't actually looking for sympathy so much as empathy. So sympathy is sort of the sense of sorrow or pity, kind of what you feel for the suffering of another person. When you're seeing the hungry child on the television, and you see the plea for help, but what the thing that's prompting you to write the check is sympathy. It's not really empathy. Because empathy, at least cognitive empathy, is the ability to experience what someone else is experiencing. Unless you've experienced prolonged hunger, you actually don't cognitively understand what that person is experiencing. What you're feeling is really sympathy. But it turns out empathy, the ability to get what someone else is going through, it turns out to be really, really important when people are looking for someone to talk to.
I want to bring in a caller who might fit into that point. Tom is with us in Neenah. Tom, hi.
Hi. Great show. I just want to say, as a guy whose wife has Alzheimer's dementia, I found myself unable to talk about things in certain ways with our kids, some of whom are in denial and some of whom they're all over the spectrum. So we formed a support group, started with just two of us, of men who have wives with Alzheimer's, and we talk about things in an entirely different way. And to your point, aren't looking for sympathy. We're all in a bad boat. we're looking for empathy, but also kind of practical advice and a feeling of I've been where you are, or, you know, and got through it, or that kind of feeling. So I was never much of a believer in support groups, and this changed my feeling about it, and I never thought about it in terms that your guest has put it until I heard this show. So thank you for that.
Tom, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Tom. I'm glad you found someone to talk with about that. And there is exactly what you were just saying, I think, Mario. He's not looking for sympathy. He's looking for somebody who's experienced the same things, bounced stories off each other and ideas. And I've heard we've talked to veterans on the show in the past who said, yeah, the best people to talk about my veteran stuff with is other veterans. Yeah. So that's a great example that Tom gave us.
Absolutely. It's absolutely right. And it's actually pretty much spot on. What's interesting about this and what Tom, I think, illustrated for us is we don't really often want to think of ourselves as people who need sympathy or help or pity. And part of the reason he hadn't done it before is perhaps it sounds like the, sort of that issue. But the need to hear someone else understands what you're going through is actually quite powerful and cathartic. And I'm actually glad to hear that he was able to find a way to find a support group where he could just talk and talk openly and frankly in a way and in a way that others would understand and in a way that even his own children perhaps were having some difficulty with.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to David with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a couple, like two friends I can talk to, two men friends I can talk to about when I got something going on. And one of the things I find is, being a friend is being a good listener, be slow to speak and quick to listen, you know, and just hear the person out. Let them say, you know, don't be quick to respond. You know, I find it very helpful for when a friend's telling you, kind of laying their soul out. And I find that it's really helpful for me and for them, you know, to just listen. Sometimes I can remember as a teenager just wanting someone to talk to, and I couldn't find anyone to talk to. It was just worst possible thing on the earth, thinking there was no one you could talk to about what you had going on. And I've always made myself available for people to do that. But like I said, be slow to speak and quick to listen, you know. And a lot of times people just want to be heard.
Gotcha. David, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, is that what people often are looking for, Mario, just to be heard, not necessarily a solution?
Absolutely. And in fact, I love that phrase, slow to speak and quick to listen. I think a lot of the time, in a lot of the cases that we saw, that's precisely what people were looking for. And, you know, the opportunity for that listener to be somebody who will just get you. Literally, they will just get what you're talking about. They don't have to give you advice, necessarily. They don't have to really often do much more than get what you're talking about. That benefit was surprisingly, surprisingly powerful for many of the people we spoke to.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mario Luis Small, author of Someone to Talk To. We'll go next to Kathy on the line in Madison. Kathy, hi.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about, Kathy?
Well, I dated a fellow in a 12-step program who has been sober for a long, long time, and initially had a job as a cab driver, and he told me that he did his 10th step, which is a confessional step, with his captive audiences in the form of his cab patrons.
Wow.
And he's been, so he goes to meetings regularly and talks about his, you know, whatever's going on with him as well. It's not like he just did it and is done with. Mm-hmm. But initially, he was working through those steps, and he felt I don't know how his cab driver, how cab patrons felt about it, but he worked through those steps as appropriate, and he's been sober ever since. So.
Kathy, well, congratulations to him, and thanks for sharing that story. So I assume some people have done the opposite and given their story to the cab driver. Here's a cab driver taking the 10th step with his fares.
That's terrific.
Did you talk to people on the receiving end? Are people, like, if we want to talk to that acquaintance, you know, somebody outside of our network, our immediate network a little bit, are people cool with that generally?
You know, so what's interesting is the answer is yes. So what I love about the cab driver example is the cab drivers are actually often in the opposite role in a way that many people in jobs where they're captive listeners end up being. So a cab driver is a lot like a bartender, and it's a lot like a barber, and it's a lot like the person, like the beautician, in that these are a lot like a trainer at a gym. These are people who have a job, technically speaking, their job is not to formally listen to you, but who have a job in which the context is intimate and the opportunity to talk is there and often end up being the confidence for a whole bunch of people.
Mario, briefly, as we wrap up, in all this research, if after the show today someone comes up to me or whoever's listening and has that story, what advice do you have as the listener, that confidant of almost random choice, if that happens?
The most important thing I would say is you don't actually have to solve anyone's problems. Listening is half the battle.
It's a good place to leave it. Mario, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Rob. It's been a pleasure.
That's Mario Luis Small. He's a sociologist and Grafstein family professor of sociology at Harvard University. He joined us to talk about his most recent book, Someone to Talk To. He studies confidants, who we go to talk about when we've got a problem, something we're trying to work out. And there's still time for you to share your story. Who do you go to when you've got something to figure out, to hash out? Do you reach out to the people closest to you in your life, that spouse, parent, sibling, whatever, closest friend? Or sometimes do you need somebody with a little bit of distance, or are you someone who people come to? Maybe because of your line of work, you're that cab driver or bartender or hairstylist or barber. Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR.